Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you, the listener of this podcast, have read at least one of the books written by my guest today. Shall we see? Here's a title, Blink. Here's another one, Outliers. Another, What the Dog Saw, David and Goliath, or his most famous work, The Tipping Point. Yes, that's right, my guest today is none other than Malcolm Gladwell, author of 5 best-selling books, a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1996, and as of late, the voice behind the new podcast, Revisionist History. So you've written books, magazine features, blog posts, and now you've moved on to podcasting. What made you decide to go the auditory route instead of kind of doing Revisionist History as another book or something like that?
Well, my friend Jacob Weisberg, who runs a podcasting company, asked me if I wanted to do one, and I said, why not? I think I was procrastinating about writing my next book, and I was looking for some excuse to do something else. And then I just did it as a lark. I didn't really have any, I had never done something like this before, and struck me as really fun. And I thought it was going to be really simple, and, you know, it would take me 6 weeks, and I would go back to my normal, and of course, you know, 6 months later, I discovered this is actually a full-time job. But I'm glad
I
discovered.
Did you listen to podcasts before? Were there some that you enjoyed before you started this, or was it like kind of a one-off? Let me see what this is all about.
Well, I'm a runner, and I don't listen to things when I run. But I hurt my knee, and so I became. I spent a year just doing the elliptical, and so while I was rehabbing my knee, I began to listen to podcasts. So I listened to, this is before I started to do my, this, you know, I did Serial. I've always listened to Bill Simmons's podcast. I got into it then, but I never, in a way, I'm not really, because I don't really like having buds in my ears. And so I'm not a natural audience for this medium. I don't drive, and I don't commute, you know, I don't drive to work every morning. So, the two big opportunities to have been a big consumer were not there for me.
So in your podcast, Revisionist History, which I love the title, you bounce around from, you know, all different types of stories in this series. You do a golf course in L.A., the Civil Rights Movement, McDonald's French fries. How do you find your stories, either for the podcast or for books or whatever? Where do you just kind of pluck something out of the air? How does it come to you?
Well, that's the, I don't know. I wish I had a better system. I'm always desperate for the next one. With this season, I had 6 ideas pretty quickly, and then I turned them into 7 by splitting one story into 2. And then I turned them into 8 by splitting another story into 2. And then, you know, and then we had 9, and I needed one more, and I, for the life of me, had no clue what the last one was going to be. And then I had this idea that I would do something on country music. And then I went to Nashville. And I was up against a deadline. So everything else was in the can. And we had number 10 wasn't even an idea. And I had like 2 weeks. So I went to Nashville with this kind of lame idea, I thought. And I interviewed this guy. And it was an amazing interview. And then I went home and I looked at my tape recorder. And I thought, as it turned out, thank God, wrongly, that I hadn't recorded the interview, or I had recorded it on a volume so low, and I just thought, I am screwed. I got 2 weeks left. I had one shot. I came all the way to Nashville. I got this guy. Against all odds, he turned out to be great, and then I screwed up the recording. It was the worst, like, 4 hours of my life while I waited for my producer to tell me whether the sound was usable. But it, so, you know, it was like, I came pretty close to not having a tenth story, but, you know, you sort of have to, like, at a certain point, just have faith that if you start something, something will emerge.
So, like, let's walk, can you walk us through the, I know the episode's not out yet, but can you walk us through the McDonald's French fries one? How does that come about? How do you decide, okay, I'm going to do something on McDonald's French fries?
Well, I had, years ago, I had done this, I can't even remember why, years ago, about a little New Yorker article about French fries, which wasn't very good. But in that article, which nobody, I think, read, I had in passing talked about McDonald's changing the recipe for how to make fries. And then I'd also years ago done a story where I'd hung out with these people in San Francisco who run a food R&D lab. And I really liked them. And they were, and I sort of stayed in touch with them. They were really fun. So then I just had the idea that since it's radio, you're always looking for scenes. I thought, wouldn't it be great to get the guys at the R&D lab to make me fries the old-fashioned way? Because they can make any food in the world. You tell them, you know, if you want 17th century goulash, they'll make you 17th century goulash, right? So, so I said, I thought, what if they made me McDonald's fries the old way, the way that McDonald's used to make them, and then make them the new way, because McDonald's changed the recipe in 1990. and I'll do a blind taste test, and it'll be really fun to do. So I just called them up, and I was like, will we do this? And they were like, totally. So I just flew out to San Francisco, and the heart of the story is just, I mean, other stuff happens, but it's just me in this lab outside of San Francisco with these hilarious food tasters, food engineers, taste testing fries. And I just thought that's fun. I mean, it's the whole, that episode, so many of my episodes are in this series, in this season are so serious, and particularly the heavy ones have not hit yet. There's some really heavy ones coming. So I just thought I need to have something that's lighthearted. And so this one's just a lark. I mean, it's, we're literally eating fries for 10 minutes of the
episode. Could you tell the difference?
Oh my God. I mean, I'm not going to ruin it, but the short answer is absolutely. I mean, it's not even an issue.
Okay, good. I can't wait to listen to that one. So you were talking about, you know, heavy issues. You know, you covered a lot of racial issues, and specifically mm-hmm. around the civil rights in this latest series. Was that brought on by the Black Lives Matter movement, or was that just a part of what happened in history that you kind of really wanted to look at? What brought that about?
Well, I've always been, partly because of my own racial heritage and partly because just idiosyncratic interest, I've always been really interested in the civil rights movement. And I, you know, I had a big chunk of my last book was about Birmingham. And I have, you know, my library of civil rights books is, you know, I probably have 100 books just on the civil rights movement. So I've read really deeply in it. It's just, I just find it fascinating. And I just felt there were so many fantastic stories to tell about that era. And also from a kind of podcasting standpoint, there's incredible archival audio. And so anytime you get a matchup between archival audio and your own personal interest, it's a win. I mean, it's just like, it was a natural to do. And I have a kind of a point of view on this. You know, these are issues that make me angry. So because the podcast medium is so conducive to, your point of view really comes through because you're using your voice, you know, you're using the engine of your point of view. So it just seemed like I had things I wanted to say. I had archival footage. And then what's coming up in the two episodes that haven't aired yet are, I had these two long conversations with Vernon Jordan, who's one of the greatest storytellers of all time. And so once I had that, I was like, oh my goodness, you know, I've got this guy telling these unbelievable stories. And so I was, that was enough. I was off to the races.
And what, can you give us a preview of what one of those stories was, or the...
Well, Vernon got out of law school in 1958 or 9 and went to work for one of the few black lawyers in the state of Georgia, a man named Donald Hollowell. And that was a time, you know, this is before the big breakthroughs in civil rights, when there were almost no black attorneys in the South. And he basically traveled around the South taking on impossible cases. And so he just tells me stories of those years. And then I put them in sort of context. And they're heartbreaking stories. I mean, they are
heartbreaking
stories. And, you know, the idea that there is someone still alive who remembers that era and can tell you about it. And it, because when you listen to them, you think this is the 19th century. And then you remember, oh, no. I recorded this interview 3 months ago in Rockefeller Center with a guy who goes to work every day. Like, it's that level of immediacy that makes, I think, it so powerful.
Have you, after kind of working on these civil rights stories, have you thought more or differently about the current racial issues in America, especially, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, but also, you know, what's been happening with the police, you know, mm-hmm. who often shoot unarmed black kids or, you know, situations like that and don't end up getting in trouble for it. Have those early stories made you think about these latest ones differently?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the first thing I did once this season wrapped was, I'm now working on this book, and I started reading
about... What is
about,
the book?
Pardon me?
What is the book, the new book?
Oh, I don't even know. I don't have a title yet. It's just a book. I mean, I'm just starting out. It's hard to explain. I haven't really figured out what it's about, but I know what I'm interested in. And I'm interested in... One of the first things I started to do was to read very deeply about these police shootings and the behavior of police in these circumstances. And so it's like, you know, there's no line that separates the stuff I think about for my articles and my books and the stuff I think about for my podcast. They inform each other. And I absolutely, listening to Vernon Jordan and doing these stories on the Brown case and Birmingham, it kind of radicalized me, I think. It made me much more interested in digging around in these issues.
So one of the things, you know, when I listen to these stories and your writings in the past too, is it seems like history often gets things wrong. is that the case, or is it just that these are kind of the sad anomalies where history got things wrong, or is it that most history is wrong?
Well, it's not that history is wrong. It's that human memory is flawed. So the stories that we tell each other all the time are always wrong in some way. They're never perfect. And when you try and put together many people's memories to construct a historical narrative, you're going to incorporate an extraordinary amount of bias and subjectivity and just plain error. The thing when I was a newspaper reporter, and you'll know this, that it took me years to learn was that the reason you check everything someone tells you is that most of what people tell you isn't true. Not because they're lying to you, but just because they remember it wrong. And that's why you have to check it. If you don't check stuff, you know, I was always fascinated at the New Yorker. You'd work on some piece for 2 months. You'd be incredibly careful about your facts. You give it to the fact checker, and invariably, the fact checker would find, at minimum, 25 errors, 50 errors. You know, that's just human, you know, that's our, the process by which human beings assemble and make sense of facts is so error prone and so biased that there's always going to be an opportunity to tell a story a different way.
So you've described yourself, are you religious? You're a Christian, right?
I come from a very religious background. My own relationship to religiosity is complicated, but I am extraordinarily sympathetic to religiosity, yes.
Do you think that there's a lot of revisionist history in things like the Bible? I mean, it's hard to tell. I know we can't really go back and ask anyone, but yeah. You know, when listening to your show, and you know, the one that kind of got me thinking this was the episode about the statue in Birmingham with the kid and the dog, and I started thinking, wow, that's just one statue, you know. Isn't everything going to have this? And then I started thinking about, you know, kind of the religious aspect of the South and so on, and wondering if maybe there's any way to tell, or if it's just kind of, it is what it is.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, look, a huge amount of theology is exactly that, is arguing over the correct way to make sense of the historical record when it comes to... I mean, I remember going to Bible camp, actually, as a kid. And there was a very brilliant pastor who ran it, a guy named Vernon Lease. And Vernon made us all stand at the blackboard with a piece of chalk, and he read to us from a piece of scripture, and we all had to write down what he said, what we heard. And at the end, after about 10 minutes, we all sat down and we examined everyone's writings on the blackboard, and we noticed how different, how many like errors had crept in, how many, some people had dropped words, some people had mixed up tenses, you know. And his whole point was, this is what the Bible is. It's people, the Bible was created by people like you, taking down stories, and they didn't get it perfectly. And so you have to kind of keep that in mind when you make sense of biblical stories. I've never forgotten that. That was my earliest, I was probably 8. That was my earliest introduction to the kind of inherent subjectivity of history.
That was your first episode of Revisionist History.
That was my first episode of Revisionist
History. Didn't have your tape recorder working yet.
Yes.
I wrote one of my books, Hatching Twitter, was about the founding of the startup that Donald Trump loves to use. And one of the things that was so fascinating was when I first approached it, was there was this narrative out there that Jack Dorsey started it when he was 7 and in his bedroom, and it was this idea. And what I found in the reporting was that was complete and utter, to be frank, bullshit. there were dozens of people that worked at the company that founded it. They were all throwing spaghetti against the wall. Twitter ended up being the one piece of penne that actually stuck. And the thing that I found this over and over again covering Silicon Valley, that so much of the history of a company is just completely made up. Why do you think that happens? Is it because it's good? The person who ends up running the company wants the power and the credit? Is it a, you know, as you just said, a game of telephone in the media or something like that? Or is it monetary? Why does this happen with companies?
Well, I think it's more fundamental. I don't think it's nefarious. I think it's a kind of, you know, there's some really excellent work on our memory of sort of the narratives we tell about memory. There's a huge amount of work on this. But one of the things that is very striking to me in that work is that over time, what happens with our memories is that we foreground ourselves and we prune away details that complicate. So if you, there's a really brilliant book that I read years ago about someone was looking at civil rights narratives, comparing the stories people told at the time with the stories they told years later. And what happens is they move the focal point over the years. So they tell the story originally and they're like, and I was in Nashville when I heard Dr. King had been shot, and I got in my car and I drove that night to Memphis and I went into his, you know. 20 years later, they're like, you know, 10 years later, they were like, and I was, you know, across town and I heard he was shot and I like got in my car and I drove. And then, like, finally, I was in Memphis right there when he was shot. And, you know, you're not deliberately lying, but the thing that your memory is focused on is that this was a hugely important moment, and you were there for some crucial part of the emotional drama, and it affected you as if you had been there when he was shot, right? Your memory cares about the emotional truth, and each of those three stories is emotionally the same. They are all saying the same thing, which was, this is one of the most important things that ever happened to me, and I participated in it. But the facts, the fact of how you participated in it, is something that just gets warped over time. You know, eventually you just simplify it, and so that all that's left is the emotional truth. Well, this is what's happening in people's narratives about companies. They're just, over time, they're kind of pruning away everyone, all the complicating factors, and they're putting themselves in the foreground, in the center of the narrative. I don't think that's deliberate. That's just what we do as human beings, you know? It's a kind of central fact. Our memory is not interested in recreating a perfect videotaped version of events. It's interesting in memorializing emotional truth.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
These days, there are so many podcasts to choose from, but finding a good financial podcast that tackles the hard-hitting money and investing questions without the financial boring jargon that comes with such a topic is not so easy. That's why I listen to Jill Schlesinger's podcast, Better Off. Jill interviews informative and entertaining guests each week to uncover surprising financial insights and give you actionable information to make the most of your money. One of my favorites is her recent episode with my colleague at Vanity Fair, Michael Lewis, who is the best-selling author of Moneyball, The Blind Side, The Big Short, and a bunch of other books that all got turned into fantastic movies. I'm a huge fan of Michael's work, and his interview with Jill is really wonderful. Together, they focus on his latest book, The Undoing Project, which explores how a bizarre friendship led to the creation of the field of behavioral economics, which in turn revolutionized big data, advanced the field of evidence-based medicine, and led to new approaches in government regulation. Be sure to check out Michael Lewis on Better Off with Jill Schlesinger, wherever you subscribe to your favorite podcasts. It's really one that you shouldn't miss. So, Winston Churchill once said, and we all love this and know this quote, "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." And I used to believe that in politics and war that was actually the case. And I think it was the case. But is it still the case with, you know, with 24-hour news cycles, always on social media, the President of the United States tweeting and tweeting and tweeting? Is there any way, for example, that the Trump administration will be able to revise the history of all this Russian stuff, do we live in a different era where technology has changed who writes history?
No, I don't know. But remember, you know, I'm not convinced this moment is that much different from previous moments. You know, in Churchill's time, everything was written down. So there's a voluminous kind of written record, but even that doesn't prevent people from telling their side of the story. You know, so today we have a voluminous digital record. It's not going to prove any more of an impediment to people being subjective about history. That, in fact, it might even be a bigger impediment, just because the volume.
So much stuff. Yeah.
It's just so much stuff. Who's going to have time to go through it? You know, I was one of the episode that drops tonight is about Churchill. And it's based on the work of this really brilliant, really brilliant Indian historian, and she went to the British archives and read a whole series of archives about crucial facts about English naval policy in the Second World War, it's clear no one had ever read them before, so it's like it's 2017. And there was a huge cache of absolutely crucial documents in the British archive, which bear directly on one of the most crucial events of the war. And nobody read it until a physicist from India asked in like 2009 if she could read them. Like, so it just gives you a sense, like, there's so much that, and this is from 70, 80 years ago, when, you know, the fraction of stuff on the record was, when the amount of stuff on the record was a fraction of what it is now. So, you know, the historians, if anything, history is going to be even more subjective in the future, because it'll just be impossible to wrap your hands around. the kind of the record of what happened.
Well, that's depressing. just to shift gears for a minute, I'm just going to bounce around with a few questions. Speaking of mean people on Twitter, a few years ago you wrote a piece in The New Yorker in response to a Gawker article about smarm, which to me felt like a word for justification about mean people on the internet. I personally feel like the meanness of the internet and Twitter and things like that is one of the worst things that is that has happened as a result of it. Do you still feel, what are your thoughts on that? Because I know it's something that you care about quite a bit.
Oh.
So I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah. I don't know. I just tune out the meanness now. And so I'm not dwelling on it anymore. And I find that the interactions that I have on the internet aren't that mean. So I'm not sure. Like, I had some guy emailed me the other day. He was very upset about the last episode that aired of Revisionist History. And I, really upset, called him all kinds of names. He thought it was reckless of me to re-examine that story and didn't understand what I was getting at and thought I was doing a disservice to the civil rights movement. But I wrote him back a very thoughtful email, which I said, here are my reasons. I'm glad you listened. Then he wrote me back an email that was softer in tone saying, you know, actually, I like a lot of your stuff, but I did have a problem with that. Can you explain this more? I'm still upset. So then I wrote him a longer email explaining that. And then he wrote me back and he was like, thank you. You've satisfied my curiosity. I accept your explanation. I'm going to keep listening. So, like, it made me realize that a lot of what looks like meanness on the internet is simply, it's inadvertent. There wasn't a malicious bone in his body. He was expressing his frustration, but the internet just makes it easy for you to express your frustration in an intemperate way. What he was really doing was asking me a question. Mm-hmm. And I answered the question, and he actually, then our conversation became very civil. And what he was also doing was he wanted to be heard. He didn't mean to be mean, but he wanted me to know that one of my listeners had an issue with, he turns out he'd read all my books and, like, you know, so he felt he had standing to say, look, dude, I've been reading you for years. I listened to all your podcasts. This one rubbed me the wrong way. So once I sort of understood his position, I realized he wasn't actually mean-spirited at all. He was the opposite. Hmm. My sense is an awful lot of what sounds like viciousness online is actually that. It is simply people wanting attention and wanting to ask questions, but not knowing how to do it in a civil way.
Unless, of course, your last name is Trump.
yeah.
Moving on. So can you tell us a little bit about what your day is like? What your media consumption is? Do you wake up? You said you were a runner. Do you listen to podcasts now when you run? Do you read the print paper? Or do you read print books? Do you read books? I mean, what is a day in the life of Malcolm
Gladwell? Well, I read a lot. I only read print books. I don't really like reading online that much. I read the paper New York Times at lunch. I don't really read it before then. I read two websites in the morning, Marginal Revolution.
Which are?
Marginal Revolution, Tyler Cohen, and Let's Run, which is my special running website. And then as my reward for being a diligent, hardworking person, in the afternoons I read The Ringer, Bill Simmons' sports website.
So you don't procrastinate during the day and like go on social media and
You know, I will check to see what people are saying about my podcast episode if one has just dropped, and I will I do at some point during the day go through my Twitter feed because I have It's how I, you know, I, it's very useful to figure out, you know, points me to all kinds of interesting directions. No, I'm not someone who spends, I will look at cars online because I'm a car nut, but I don't really, I'm not someone who spends a lot of time procrastinating online. I always run out of ideas about what to look up online, so then I just go back to work.
And do you watch like TV and movies and things like that, or are you?
No, I don't really watch. I watch sports on television. I watch track meets on my computer. I have at this point highly edited. I read lots and lots of thrillers. I read books that are related to the things I'm interested in at the moment. I read lots of, I have huge stacks of journal articles that I read, I send my assistant, you know, 20 sites, and she delivers me a stack of printouts and I read through them. That's usually, I don't really have time to do, and then I usually run in the late afternoons.
How far do you run when you run?
Well, when I'm doing a long run, I might run 10 miles. When I'm doing a workout, you know, tonight I'll go to my, I belong to a track club and we'll do a track workout. Or I'll run hills or some. I have various running buddies here and there who I run with and who share the same masochistic tendencies as I have. You know, I don't have the world's most exciting life.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I don't know about you, but shopping for new clothes in physical stores can be a bit boring. And yet shopping for clothes online can be equally as tedious. That is until I discovered Bombfell, which is absolutely the easiest, most enjoyable way to buy clothes on the internet, or off the internet for that matter. The way it works is you go to the website, fill out a simple questionnaire, and then you're given a personal stylist who sends you clothes to try on. It's free to sign up, and you only get charged for the clothes that you keep. Once you sign up, you wait for your clothes to arrive, and then try them on at your convenience, in your home, or wherever you'd like. You get free shipping, free returns, and they never charge above retail price. It's really that simple. And Bombfell is the only styling service that does not charge any fees to work with them. You don't need to worry about random stuff showing up at your door either. Your Bombfell stylist emails you their selection before sending anything off. You're in total control. It's fully personalized, so every piece of clothing has been handpicked just for you by your own stylist. For listeners of Inside the Hive, Bombfell is offering a $25 off your first purchase. That's like a free t-shirt just to try the service. All you need to do is go to bombfell.com/thehive. That's bombfell.com/hive to get your free $25 towards your first purchase. What's one of your favorite stories that you've ever worked on? If you had to pick one, whether it's from a book or a podcast or a blog post or even a tweet, like what's the your favorite thing that you've ever done? Or if you had to tell someone that they should read or listen to or something, what would it
be? Oh dear. Let's see. There's one episode, the one I just described about country music, the one that nearly fell apart, the idea that I didn't have until the very last moment. I'm actually very proud of that episode because it's sort of, the writing of my own that I like the most is the stuff that verges on self-parody. So I think that when I'm being mischievous and when I'm making fun of my own slightly pretentious tendencies, that's when I feel I'm at my best. So I like it when the argument I'm making is more than a little bit absurd. And so this episode.
So what's the argument you're making in this episode?
It's a little bit absurd. I mean, what is the argument?
It's
an argument about why an episode about the sad song divide. Why does country music have lots of sad songs and rock and roll doesn't really have any good ones anyway? It has bad ones, but not good ones. Which is a plausible enough question to ask, I suppose. But my investigation of this is, I mean, let's be clear, absurd. I mean, I'm just having fun. I mean, I'm really making fun of myself. I'm I'm doing a kind of parody of a Malcolm Gladwell piece about country music. And I'm sorry, I just found the whole thing so hilarious and so absurd. And I, you know, if you're not rolling your eyes halfway through, I have failed. I mean, it's supposed to be. The golf episode was also, I'm very fond of that episode because it's just, I mean, by the time I'm talking to the philosopher, I mean, it's absurd, right? It's just, this again is self-parody. It's like, of course, I would call up a philosopher to ask about the Ship of Theseus paradox as it relates to Los Angeles country clubs. Like at that point, I'm just thinking about what is the best way to kind of make fun of my own persona, you know? Anyway, I've always preferred that mode. And if you look at the writing I did as a kid, it was all tongue-in-cheek. It was all, you know, absurd intellectual investigations of seemingly serious topics. So that's how I kind of got my start in writing. And I like to return to that whenever I can get away with it.
So can you, without, you know, I'm sure everyone's going to listen to that episode of the country song, but can you tell us why there are no sad rock and roll songs and so many sad country songs?
Well, I have a semi-serious theory about specificity, that you cry when melancholy collides with specificity, with detail. So I can get you, and I have this whole, one of the things I do is I compare Emmylou Harris's From Boulder to Birmingham with the Rolling Stones' Wild Horses. And it's absurd, but my whole thing is that Wild Horses is a terrible song. And it fails because it's just, the lyrics are juvenile. I mean, you have no idea what Mick Jagger's saying. And From Boulder to Birmingham, on the other hand, is a masterpiece. You know, it's all about the specificity of the image, images in that song. And then I go into this long thing about George Jones. And it ends up semi-serious, but like I'm basically pretending that all of rock and roll is a kind of meaningless exercise in mindless extroversion. And that country music is an investigation of hard-won emotional truths. And that if you, and further on top of that, I suggest that, and if you don't see that, if you aren't on country music side, then you're vacuous and shallow. Which like, is, you know, it's just like, I mean, what's not to like?
So where does Johnny Cash fall? I mean,
Well, I don't talk about Johnny Cash. I could have. I mean, there's a million different directions. Perhaps that'll be part two next season. But, you know, he's to my point. I could have done a whole thing about, you know, the two versions of Hurt. One with great emotional solemnity and one which is just self-indulgent and petty. Yeah, there's lots to be said.
So last few questions and then we'll let you get back to your running websites and so on. Are you planning a third season for Revisionist History?
I'll keep doing it as long as I can come up with 10 ideas. I mean, like, it's not easy, by the way. It's like brutally hard.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I hope so. I really enjoy it.
So and when you approach your, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that have read your books and listened to the podcasts and your stories in New York and so on. What's your process for? I mean, I would say, you know, even podcasts or writing. What is your process? Do you outline everything first? Do you do the reporting and let that lead you in the direction? Do you just kind of start writing and it all comes together? What is a process for you in your creation experience?
Well, it differs. From this book I'm working on now, I started. I have little things that I'm interested in, and I go and I like do long interviews and see whether it kind of I remain interested in the subject. The real question is, can this topic sustain the amount of investigation I need to do something meaningful with it? So you need to know whether it has legs. So a lot of the early reporting is just seeing, is there something there or is this a blog post? You know? Now, I don't mean to demean blog posts, but I mean, is it 500 words or is it 50,000 words? That's what I'm trying to figure out. And that's not obvious a lot of the time. And then I accumulate, after I've accumulated a certain number of these stories, I try and do an outline. So for this book I'm writing, I've written the introduction. Now, I don't know whether that'll be the introduction to the actual book, but it's the introduction that allows me to keep going with the book because it sort of signposts what interests me. And then I just kind of start in the, and I kind of start in the middle. I write as I go along, always.
You start in the middle and you kind of piece it all together by the end?
Yeah, like I'll do, there's a specific chapter of my book I'm going to try and work on over the next month or month and a half. And it requires, the thing I did this morning was I figured out there's one guy at the Natural History Museum who I really need to talk to him about this trip he took to New Guinea. I don't know where he is. I hope he's not in New Guinea because it's going to be hard. I want to go and see him. He hasn't returned my email yet. But, you know, and I realized I read these series of these articles and I realized, oh, these journal papers he did. And I was like, oh, I recognize in all of this very dry psychology writing that there's a great story here that if I just sat down with him, it would be amazing. And it's a wonderful way into this argument I want to make in this chapter. So there is a case where I kind of been rooting around. Last week I went to Boston and interviewed someone who was really good, but her story is not the right one. And I think this guy's is. So I'm just looking for the kind of signature story. And when I find it, then everything will drop into place. So it's like, a lot of it is searching for, I went to Washington 2 weeks ago and interviewed a guy. I thought he was going to be that, but he's not. But then I found another guy, and I think he's the guy. You know, I'm going to go back to Washington and interview somebody. You know, it's like, it's constantly searching for somebody who embodies what I want to write about.
It sounds like it's almost like a game of Tetris where you're waiting for that perfect piece.
Yes, I'm waiting for the... But I it's easier if you have a kind of general sense of where you're headed. And doing the podcast is really interesting because it's made me think more. I've never in my life had to think about mix before. And with the podcast,
about what, sorry?
About mix. So you have 10 stories and they can't all be the same. So, you know, you ask people to listen every week for 10 weeks. There has to be variety. And so now I'm thinking like a booker for a talk show. You know, like you don't interview Jennifer Aniston and then interview someone who's just like Jennifer Aniston, right? Then you bring in the anthropologist or the something else. You know, you kind of, and I have to think, and I'm now much more conscious of that, and it's changed the way I think about assembling stories for this book. I'm thinking much more about mix.
They all inform each other. Yeah. So, very last question, which is something I ask all of my guests. Is if you could go back in time 20 years, or it could be 10 years if you want, and give your younger self some advice, what would it be?
Oh, wow. You know, get married. probably it.
That's it?
I think that's it, yeah.
Okay. Any work-related advice?
Advice?
No, it doesn't have to be. I just, you know, I'm just curious.
What would I have done differently? Well, you know, I had an opportunity when I worked at the Washington Post to be an overseas correspondent, to be the German correspondent, and I turned it down. And I think I should have said yes. I could have used a good dose of another country. I think that would have made me a much more interesting writer and person.
So who knows? Maybe you'll end up in New Guinea.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's why I'm holding out for a side trip to New Guinea. But no, I think I would have been more adventurous in where I chose to live.
And you've been in New York for how long now?
20 some odd years.
Got it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. And people can get the podcast on iTunes and at revisionisthistory.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks to my guest today, Malcolm Gladwell. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Tweet it out to your friends, share it on Facebook, anything you want to do. Thanks also to the folks at Digital Media for their production work and my editors at Vanity Fair. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors, BetterOff and Baumfell. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll see you next week.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.